Tennessee. Her books include Highland Heritage, Scottish Americans in the American South, Southern Heritage on Display, Public Ritual and Ethnic Diversity Within Southern Regionalism, Signifying Serpents and Mardi Gras Runners, Representing Identity in Selected South, and of course the ethnicity volume of the New Encyclopedia of Southern Culture. Her current research interests are in ethnoecology, sacred landscapes, and the holy wells of Scotland and Ireland. And the topic today, the title of her lecture, is The Creole South. Please join me in welcoming Professor Ray.
Well, thank you, everyone. I know you just probably ate turkey and pasta as I did, so you better not go to sleep on me. This volume was one of the most enjoyable projects I've ever done, and thank you, Charles, for inviting me to do it. I had an excuse to contact people I'd always wanted to meet and ask them to talk about people I'd always found interesting. So few academic gigs could be better. I really enjoyed it. This is the cover, obviously. You're going to look at it for a little while. Research on ethnicity in the South is a bit tricky because it's a moving target. We're continually getting new immigrants from around the world. So the original ethnic life section in the 1989 encyclopedia included 30 groups, and we've expanded this to 88 groups that were covered and 8 introductory essays, and still there were 20 more I wish we could have included. As in U.S. history, Native Americans are often neglected in Southern studies, but since these first Southerners founded myriad proto-states and chiefdoms, we had 34 entries added to this volume on them, on federally and state-recognized nations. My goal in this volume was to redirect the scholarly lens from race to culture. Important point for me. Ethnicity refers to cultural and social aspects of identity, not biological characteristics or phenotype, your appearance. Despite the conflation of the two terms in popular media, ethnicity does not mean race. The concept comes from the ancient Greek word ethnos, meaning people or nation. And Herodotus flexibly described Dorians, Ionians, and Ephesians as ethne, as different ethnic groups, different nations, based on what festivals they celebrated, what foods they ate, their imaginative genealogies connecting them to heroic ancestors, and the geographic origins of their people. Anthropologists today define ethnicity in a very similar way, by looking at people who have shared customs, cuisine, clothing, foodways, well, I just mentioned cuisines, language, dialect, and geographical origins. So we call these things ethnic boundary markers, and whether or not people play those up depends on how important ethnicity is to them. It's actually very fluid and can evolve, can be forgotten, can be reclaimed. Not only may an individual be a member of more than one ethnic group, one may share an ethnic identity with those that society might designate a different race from oneself. Increasingly, Americans are identifying as multi-ethnic, so that Irish Americans not only celebrate their Irish heritage, but they might celebrate being Irish German Americans, or Irish Mexican Americans, or Irish French Americans. Southerners can simultaneously feel Chinese and Southern, or feel Italian and Southern, and sometimes conflate the two in expressive cultures, especially at festivals, which are good indicators to anthropologists of the evolution and recombination of ethnic identities, which are cultural identities. However, the true cultural diversity within Southern subregions has been obscured by the late 19th and 20th century focus on binary racial classifications. So this volume was an attempt to add some actual color to understandings of the South, which have just been black and white, and to consider Southern culture as a Creole. That said, scholars debate the meaning of Creole almost as often as they use it. So it could be a person of French or Spanish descent born in the South or in the Western Hemisphere, or it could refer to a French speaker of African descent. A Creole can be a language like Gullah, which replaces a pidgin, a primary form of communication between people who speak different languages. A Creole can be a musical form like Zydeco. It can be, of course, cuisine, as we've heard about, gumbo, jambalaya, crawfish etouffee. These are all Creole dishes. Any of these and all of these definitions then are correct. The creation of such cultural hybrids, that was my Florida coming out, hybrids, I'm supposed to be speaking from behind a podium, is none too cleverly called creolization, something that anthropologists have been very excited about for the last decade. What is that? It's the gradual blending of cultures after a long period of exposure and sharing and interaction of multiple social groups. So what we think of as typically Southern is actually the product of over 20 generations of such sharing. More than any region in the country, the South has the longest lived and most complex exchanges between numerous indigenous ethnic groups and those from Europe and Africa. Country music and the blues grew up together, the artist of one style influencing the artist of the others, which we may hear about from Bill Malone later. Our superlative foodways, which we've heard about, are also reflective of such sharing. Native Americans, yes, I actually worked the automatic. From Native Americans, we get traditions like, of course, grits and hominy and succotash and cornbread and the use of sassafras leaves for a thickener and gumbo or for drinks like sarsaparilla and root beer. From West African cooking, we get hopping john and candied yams, those things we top with marshmallows and call it a vegetable. For better or for worse, a variety of dishes with okra. Our English dialect is punctuated with loan words. From Africa, we get one that's very popular with my students right now. Zombies are everywhere. replacing vampires and werewolves. Our architecture marries European styles with Western vernacular, West African traditions and Caribbean traditions. So you've got the classic Georgian Charleston I house, sometimes called a single, with a Caribbean porch down one side. The South, of course, also has many Creole populations. You've got Red Bones in many of the states. You've got Melungeons in eastern Tennessee and western North Carolina. You've got the Blues of North Carolina and the Lumbee. You've got the Santees, the Brass Ankles, and the Turks of South Carolina. And additionally, there are groups that adopt each other's ethnic boundary markers to express their own identity. So the Mardi Gras Indians, which you see here, developed because African Americans were prohibited from festival masking in the 19th century in New Orleans because of the Black Codes. So they decided to opt to mask everything except for their faces. And they did so with what had become stereotypical Native American dress, with feathered and beaded headdresses and bustles in exuberant colors. And, of course, this is really the dress of Plains Indians, but became what we kind of consider Native American dress across the country. They developed neighborhood tribes, each with their own big chief, and occasionally employ pseudo-Native American terms in their call and response singing during parades. Some in the Skull and Bone Clubs, also neighborhood-based, are voodoo workers and wake the spirits on the days of parades, letting the spirits ride them, so that African trickster characters and deities are considered present in parades put on by Methodist and Baptist wearing their own interpretation of Native American clothing. This is what I mean by Creole. Southern culture and its sub-regional expressions then is a complex amalgam. The sum is undoubtedly greater than its parts, but it's hardly a finished product. After 9/11, more immigrants were directed away from Boston and New York, which have the longest processing time periods, to smaller southern cities so that Fort Payne, Alabama, and Murfreesboro, Tennessee, have had demographic revolutions in the last decade, in a very short period. our expectations of immigrants have also changed from the assimilation model in which immigrants were expected to adopt the language and culture of the new country. Americans moved in the 1950s and 60s to pluralism, which is a coexistence of homeland traditions, but the adoption of mainstream culture in public context. And in the 1980s and 90s, multiculturalism replaced pluralism with a celebration of difference and no expectation that immigrants conform to mainstream culture. It remains to be seen how or if a veiled non-English speaking immigrant will consider herself a Southerner. But pundits have been saying the end of Southern regionalism was coming for decades, as we heard from Charles last evening, and yet here we are today in 2013 still talking about it. Perhaps the most constant thing about regionalism is its continual evolution. Rather than give you an immigration history or try to sample the 88 groups considered in the volume, I thought I'd talk to you about a case study, which was one of my first research projects on Scottish Americans and the South. And I hope to attend the Central Kentucky Highland Games tomorrow in Eminence. Is anyone going by any wild chance? Okay. It's just nearby. It's not something I ever expected to get interested in, this whole tartan craze with kilts and banners, and couldn't have cared less about it when I went to the University of Edinburgh to study Iron Age archaeology. But when I came back to North Carolina to finish graduate studies over 20 years ago, I started going to Scottish events and games because I just missed Scots and the Scottish people. And I met people at these events who also missed Scotland but had never been there. They had very particular attachments to certain hills and glens based on folklore and song. And they told me fabulous stories about their family histories. They were part of one of the largest migrations of Highlanders to America in the 18th century into what is now North Carolina, into the Cape Fear River Valley, when 40,000 at least came before the Revolution. And it's an area where many residents still farm the land settled by their immigrant ancestors 250 years ago. They still attend the Presbyterian churches their ancestors founded in the 1750s. This is a reunion shot at Long Street Presbyterian Church, founded in 1758. So I thought about doing an archaeological survey of the river valley. And as I started interviewing people about their family histories, they would bring down swatches of their fourth great-grandfather's kilts. And I thought, gosh, you know, this is a lot more interesting than house foundations. And I switched my studies, from archaeology to cultural anthropology and started talking to Scots all over the South. From Georgia to Mississippi to Arkansas, I met Southerners dressed in hoop skirts at Scottish Highland Games and in images such as this advertisement for the Natchez, Mississippi Fall Pilgrimage, a tour of antebellum homes. So what have you got here? You've got a woman in a variation of a Clanshaw tartan, a child in a matching Glengarry hat with an old Southern oak plantation. How did this cultural hybrid develop? Well, in recent decades, growing interest in Americans' cultural and ancestral ties to Scotland has produced hundreds of new Scottish clan and heritage societies. Scottish American ethnic awareness has had other periods of organization and celebration, but it was the late 20th century that really saw a huge growth in cultural groups and gatherings, most dramatically in the South. Where a unique and distinctly regional style flavors events and perceptions of Scottish origins. One half of all Scottish American associations are based in the South, and more than a third, well over a third, of the 240 annual Scottish Highland Games happen in our region. This may be less surprising when you consider the surviving pockets of Scottish populations, not just in the Cape Fear, but descendants of Cape Fear Highlanders settled Alabama, Tennessee, Mississippi, Texas. Remnants of Highlander communities are still in Darien, Georgia, and Argyle, Florida. And over 47% of the Americans who claim Scots-Irish roots, I'm sure none of you in this room have any of that, are predominantly in Kentucky and Tennessee. So there is a regional concentration. Especially since America's bicentennial, when the word ethnicity became kind of more user-friendly before people started substituting it with race, these folks, like Americans in general, were rediscovering roots. The popularity, however, of the Scottish Heritage Movement in the South is due partly to its double celebration of a reclaimed Scottish ethnicity and its particular relationship to a Southern regional identity. Both Southern and Scottish identities play on a sense of historical injuries and lost causes, on links between sense of place and kinship, on connections between militarism and religious faith, and on symbolic material cultures. To explain how they blend, you first need to know something about the Scottish American community. Maybe many of you do already. The community involves those very inclusively who are involved in quite different things. Varied economic backgrounds, varied educational backgrounds. You have people coming with various other ethnic identities, sometimes in the multiple, both those calling themselves Christians and neo-pagans, and unusually these days, those of varied political perspectives, all joining together in associations which focus on community and kinship. Scottish heritage celebrants include those who discovered their ancestral origins in the climate of cultural pluralism, 1950s to the 1970s, or later in multiculturalism, the 1980s and 1990s, and those who have a transgenerational awareness of their roots. The Scottish identity embraced by Americans generally today is a Highland Gaelic identity, which descendants of Highland Scots, Lowland Scots, and Scots-Irish, the Ulster Scots, embrace equally. And it's one that was engendered largely by the poet and novelist Sir Walter Scott long after the ancestors of today's Scottish Americans left Scotland. So how the Highlands came to represent the whole of Scotland is a little bit similar to the way in which plantation owners came to represent Southerners, generally in Moonlight and Magnolia, images of the South, even though only one out of every 17 landowners could have qualified as a planter. The many attempts to restore the British throne for the Stuarts are known from the late 17th, early 18th centuries as the Jacobite Risings, and the last one ended with the defeat of this fella, Bonnie Prince Charlie, and his predominantly Highland army in 1746. The demise of his cause at Culloden Moor is the defining moment for Scottish American heritage lore and is invoked at heritage events as the chief reason for ancestral migration. Actually, fewer Scots were transported as Jacobites to America than Covenanters had been the century before. These were religious dissenters. But Culloden spurred economic and social changes in Scotland that sent tens of thousands of immigrants to the American South. So that Scottish Americans see themselves as a part of a diaspora. As defeat in the Civil War would do for the South, the Scottish Highlanders' defeat made their region the subject of romance and nostalgia. Once no longer a threat, the cultural attributes of the vanquished Highlanders eventually became symbolic of Scottish national identity. So in a type of romanticism peculiar to Scotland, non-Gaelic speaking, Lowlanders forsook the ancient Highland-Lowland cultural divide to don tartans and Highland kilts in wildly elaborated costumes, which Southern heritage enthusiasts continue to evolve further and further and even further. This is a Scottish Viking Southerner. Anyway. Although the revered ancestors saw the cloth, tartan that is, as the badge of cattle thieves, descendants of Lowland Scots and Scots-Irish today celebrate a unified vision of Scottish heritage by wearing Highland tartan. Of course, this never happens in Kentucky. Outlawed for four decades after Culloden, tartan acquired family name associations, and after almost two centuries of marketing, we have over 2,000 tartan designs or set patterns today. This is, of course, a typical tartan, which non-Scottish Americans call plaid. Although a handful of clan chiefs did have preferred tartans in the 18th century, most people just wore what was handy. The color of your tartan depended on what plants grew locally, what colored dyes you could get from them, and your local weaver's skill and fancy. So they were linked to locality, but the surname connection is a bit of a marketer ploy in the early 19th century. Now, having said this, the inventiveness does not detract from the present meaning of tartan. The Clan Tartan Association is traditional today, and all traditions are invented at some point, and they're invented to be meaningful. So as an anthropologist, I'm less worried that heritage is not history, and more interested in how and why people select certain customs and certain historical moments which they refashion as heritage. The once familiar Southern question, who are your people? I haven't been asked this in a long time, resonates very well in the Scottish Heritage Revival, in which new interpretations of the old Highland clan system have spawned its rebirth as clan societies. Clan is Gaelic for children, but has come to mean family, so that those sharing a surname and hence a tartan are considered kin to each other and to all descendants of the founding ancestor first associated with the name centuries or even millennia ago. And this is Richard Burnett. I'm afraid with the lights you can't see, but he's standing beside his family tree, linking him back to the founding ancestor of his clan. The wearer of the tartan becomes a kind of bearer of the clan reputation, so that tartan works a little bit like heraldry, and traditional enemies... Oh, there was a better slide. Traditional enemies research and revive old feuds, though somewhat playfully. And the revived clans are hierarchically structured, led by generally male chiefs with unquestioned authority on heritage issues, as they were expected to have had before Culloden, on all issues. And a male clan chief is considered the father of his clan. Even though their ancestors may have caused the Scottish diaspora, visiting clan chiefs are frequently the honored guest at Scottish Highland Games. So this is Lord MacDonald, the High Chief of Clan MacDonald, visiting a games in Culloden, Georgia, there is such a place, to, as he put it, meet and instruct his children. When a chiefly line has died out, you might elect a commander. They're usually given a military title, and this is the commander of Clan MacPhee being paraded around at Stone Mountain Games with a banner of the Clan Tartan and little... pendants noting all the battles in which MacPhees have fought. This is David Mingus of Mingus at an infant baptism at one of the games. Now, these guys might be dukes or earls, but because of their appreciation of kinship, the way they understand it, Southerners clap them on the back and call them cuz, which is really worth seeing in itself. But in Southern elaborations of Highlandism, even between clan societies, people see themselves as linked in a cousinhood. It's a cousin calling you now, which fictives would call this, or anthropologists would call this fictive kinship. But in the Scottish American world, people have come to believe this is blood kinship. So they assume that all MacNeils are blood related, or all The remarkable number of MacDonalds and MacNeils comes not from astounding ancestral fecundity, but from a time when people didn't really need last names and they allied themselves with the clan chief to borrow his. The especially Southern emphasis on clan as kin is most evident at Highland Games and gatherings, which Southern branches of clan societies advertise as family reunions. By tradition, Highland Games grew from competitions held by a king or a chief for amusement, but also to select fit young men as laborers and bodyguards. The oldest known games is at Bray Mawr in Scotland. The Queen always attends. This is herself arriving in her roles. And the largest and most prestigious in the South are at Grandfather Mountain. They're known as America's Bray Mawr. And these were begun in 1956. Today, they're a four-day event that draws over 30,000 people. One of the co-founders was the owner of the Mountain, Agnes McRae Morton. The other was a Charlotte journalist, Donald McDonald. There weren't enough people registered for the first year dancing competition, so he had to do a fling himself. But at Southern Games, unlike elsewhere, clan tents ring the games fields and are the actual focus rather than the Scottish athletics. Games are more often called gatherings in Scotland, the understood purpose being the athletic competitions. In the South, games are really just an excuse for a gathering. You may be familiar with some of the main Scottish athletics, maybe. Tossing the caber, throwing a 120-pound tree, usually pine, end over end so that it lands directly at 12 on an imaginary clock face. In parts of Florida and Wiregrass Country, games organizers like to localize the tradition by using cypress trunks, which are much denser and heavier. They weigh 140 pounds upwards, so they always have to be whittled down to some degree before you can flip the thing. This is a hammer throw, which is throwing a variously weighted object in such a way as to ensure a hernia. Dancing and musical competitions go on simultaneously, but these events are not why Southerners come to Highland Games. They may not even watch the games. They come to visit with their cousins in the clan tents, where society members greet new guests, solicit new members, discuss displays on clan history, and show images of the Scottish homelands. In the South, there are actually competitions for the best tent display. This is Clan Anderson's display of weaponry. Clan Ferguson offers Southern hospitality with Ferguson flavor. The Chisholms are displaying Jacobite history and Celtic Christianity. And this was a winning McFarland tent one year at the Stone Mountain Games, combining tartan and magnolias. Also, at Scottish Highland Games in the South, you're more likely to have barbecue or low country boils, fiddle competitions, and time designated for religious events. They're also more likely to be held at historic plantations. So Boone Hall Plantation in South Carolina hosts the Charleston Scottish Games. Rural Hill Plantation hosts Charlotte, North Carolina's Lochnorman Highland Games. And Mill Prong Plantation, built by Scottish immigrants in 1795, hosts a post-games plantation party after the games honoring the Jacobite heroine Flora MacDonald, who lived briefly in North Carolina in the 1770s. At Southern Games, one may hear bagpipe renditions of Dixie and tunes like The Bonnets of Bonnie Dundee, a song written by Sir Walter Scott about a hero of the first Jacobite Rising, but they're sung with Confederate lyrics riding a raid that honored General Jeb Stuart, who by tradition wore a white feather in his hat to emulate Bonnie Prince Charlie's white cockade. Southern heritage is also celebrated at Southern Scottish Heritage events because so many participants see their Southern identity as an outgrowth of their Scottish ancestry. Romanticizations of Southern identity did indeed build on a Scottish model, but not of continuous tradition. Old South myths assumed a paradigm with which Southerners were already well acquainted, that constructed by Highlandism and Sir Walter Scott, who was, of course, amazingly popular in the South. Southerners named pets and the occasional child after characters and places in Scott's novels. In Mississippi alone, the plantations and mansions of Waverly, which you see here, Melrose, Montrose, Dunvegan, Dunleith, and Monmouth, all received their names from Sir Walter's appreciative readers. The towns of Waverly in Tennessee, Texas, Virginia, Alabama, and Georgia all were named for Scott's Waverly novels. And there's a Waverly in Union County, Kentucky, which may have been named for the founder, Hugh McElroy's nephew, who might have been named for the novels. If anybody can clear that up for me, I'd like to talk to you later. And then, of course, you also have your local Waverly Hills, but that's probably enough said. Southerners generally identified with Scott's chivalrous castle and glen-dwelling characters as models for themselves, having the best of courtly manners and hospitality, rather than his ancestors. The motifs of Highlandism yielded many parallels for 19th century Southerners based on assumed spiritual and intellectual kinship rather than heritage as is claimed today. But after a century and a half, These perceived cultural parallels are seen as inherited cultural traits. The romancing of the Highlands and of the South was relief for the tragic consequences of both civil conflicts. And by emphasizing the military prowess of the defeated, Highlandism and the lore of the Old South redeem the masculinity of the vanquished. The stereotypical image of a Scot as a bagpiping, kilted soldier certainly finds masculine parallels in the gentleman gallants and colonel characters of Southern myth. Highland and Southern men seem to be somehow both heroic in defeat and famed for loyal military service to their former enemies following those defeats. Southern men seem, in Nina Silver's words, forever enshrined in their lost cause. Not surprisingly, then, Civil War-era reenactors sometimes appear at Highland Games. This is a group called the Georgia-Florida Line, which begin the games at the Treylon Plantation near Tallahassee by firing their cannon. VMI adopted its own tartan in 1997, and cadets have manned their own tent amongst Klan society tents. Likewise, the Highlander once defeated is perpetually dressed for battle, with claymore in hand. This is a fierce-looking 18th-century Alistair Grant with his basket-hilted saber. The late David Dysart of Tennessee, armed with a spiked targe. A targe is actually a shield, but they don't like to call it that because that's what you hide behind. So with the detachable spike, they like to call it an offensive weapon, and we've got the Braveheart factor here. Still the blue face. These soldierly male icons are interchangeable in Southern Scottish heritage celebrations, and military professionals are prominent in Scottish American communities in the South. They merge pride in career and American patriotism with pride in family heritage by combining military shirts, badges, and medals with a kilt of their clan tartan. Military members tend not to be just the rank and file. He's actually very pleasant. His ice cream is melting. But members of the Army's special forces, Navy SEALs, and officers from various branches who credit their choice of career and their success to both their Scottish and Southern ancestry. By invitation, war veterans may join the National Scottish American Military Society, which was founded in North Carolina in 1980 and has a strong presence at public rituals, Scottish American funerals, weddings, and Highland games. And here they're providing a color guard for a game in Georgia. Those of you who have been to any Scottish heritage events, anyone? Okay, well, you'll know that it's the celebration of male identities that is most expressive. It's the guys who are Bonnie. It is the guys who are the peacocks, who are the bells, and it's the men who get the most interesting tattoos. Wayne Cathy carries his McPhee tartan always and forever. Most couples, when they come to Highland Games, come like this. A woman might wear a tartan, just a shawl or something, but the men come as weekend warriors. It's the men who wear the elaborate dress and who are on display, which is part of what made my work so much fun. But Scottish games, genealogical conferences are the only places I've ever seen men leave 2 hours early to get dressed for dinner. And where else are you going to see former military men adjusting the bejeweled pins on each other's skirts? Seriously, though, while I raise the distinction between history and heritage lore, they often diverge. I didn't do so to critique the authenticity or inauthenticity of Scottish American practices, but to focus on the process of renegotiating history into heritage, to look at the practices that reshape ethnic identities, and to, as Simon Sharma writes, take myth seriously on its own terms and to respect its coherence and complexity. And the integration of Scottish and Southern lore provides a congruous and very powerful sense of identity that drives people to tattoos. So this is Tennessee Robert Wright's tattoo, which is a conflation of lost causes. He's got the Confederate battle cap and flag with the date of Appomattox, 1865, crossed with the Scottish flag and cap and the date of Culloden, 1746, and the familiar Southern slogan, "Forget hell," for both of those. Southern Scots were the very first to develop state tartans, the earliest being North Carolina, which you see here, followed by Texas and Georgia. Tennessee was the first state to set aside a tartan day in 1996, and now we have an annual national tartan day on April 6th by a Senate resolution. The Kentucky tartan was approved, I think, in 2000, so you'll know that well. And in 1997, the interweaving of Scottish and Southern heritage found both literal and symbolic expression with the introduction of a Confederate memorial tartan, featuring a Confederate gray ground with stripes of infantry blue, battle flag or artillery red, and cavalry yellow. You know your Southern Baptist raising is ever resilient when you see that word in print and you have to stop yourself from saying Calvary. It happens every time. But in this sort of fashion, through costume, through imagery, the simplified, unproblematized visions of Scottishness and of white Southernness are easily comparable and blended by those reared on the latter. But this is not the only type of creolization going on. And claiming Scottish ethnic origins, Southern Scottish Americans assert that their identity derives from more than the Civil War and reference the centuries of creolizations that make Southerners Southern. How am I on time? Okay. John Shelton Reed has noted that Southerners are more likely than Americans in any other region to claim Native American ancestry. While only 2% of Southerners identify as American Indian, that's double the statistic for the whole country, 40% claim some Native ancestry, which is almost twice the number, 22%, who claim descent from a Confederate soldier. That's a pretty strong difference. Native American trading, social, and kin links with Scots find recognition in dress and reenactment and story and displays at clan tents. Children might compete both in Highland dancing at Scottish games and in Native American dancing at Southern powwows. This is Chief Tanubi, whose father was president of an American branch of Clan MacIntosh and chief of the Creek. This is Ken Long from your state, who is dressed as a Shawnee with the Gordon tartan of his great-great-grandmother, who was captured by and married into the Shawnee. Another Gordon, Beverly Griffith, with her husband, a member of the Eastern Band of Cherokee. Scottish Americans may also claim or be socially assigned various other ethnic identities. As Scottish Highland Games, you're going to hear athletes and dancers competing with names that are Italian, Icelandic, Korean, Russian, so that surnames like Pulcinella or Gonzel or Yu or Goodmanson are just as common as Mackenzie or Graham. Increasingly, Celtic and Scottish festivals highlight a fusion of identities and expressive cultures and performances of Afro-Celt music. So-called Asian Highlanders, as they call themselves, are prominent in Southern Highland dancing competitions and participate in bagpipe bands. Mexican Scottish Americans attend games and clan society ceilings, which are gatherings for music and dance, and sport whimsical combinations of Mexican and tartan apparel, bringing haggis tamales to events and calling themselves taco tartans. While bundles of hyphens for ethnonyms might become more linguistically complicated, they're becoming socially less so. Many African Americans have Scottish ancestry and are also members of clan societies, bagpipe bands, and Scottish history reenactment groups, as he had a Scottish ancestor in the Cape Fear Valley who fought as a loyalist in the American Revolution. Xavier Allen reenacts in the 84th Regiment of Foot. Here he is on his way to a Scottish country dance. From Corinth, Mississippi, Gustavus Arias McLeod, another one of those names you were talking about earlier, is of African, Scottish, and Choctaw descent. And he has been to the Isle of Skye to meet the chief of the McLeods at Dunvegan Castle. In 1999, he became the first person to fly to the magnetic North Pole in an open cockpit plane. And when his plane was taking off, a bagpiper played. And when it was hung up in the Maryland Aviation Museum, he wore his kilt. Harrison Bailey III is a record setter in international Scottish athletic competitions. Many examples of tradition sharing in both the past and the present have yet to be documented. Yale ethnomusicologist Willie Ruff has lately argued that call and response hymns, a cappella psalm singing, that's also called line singing, came from Gaelic-speaking Highlanders used in their churches and taken on by their slaves, and that descendants of these same slaves still sing them in Alabama today. Native American drumming at powwows in North Carolina might also be accompanied by Scottish fiddle tunes. And for several years running, the Cherokee have come to the Grandfather Mountain Highland Games Celtic concerts to perform their own dances in time with the music. This case study is just but one example of the creative recasting of ethnic identity and history to produce a heritage that appeals in the present, one that will be continually rewritten in each generation, so that a future edition of the Ethnicity volume in another 20 years will be a quite different read. So I'll leave you with that. Thank you very much. So happy to take questions. Yes. At Loon Mountain?
I don't remember the name of the mountain, but I'm still getting brochures once a year.
You want to know how to make them stop? You want to know how to make them stop sending you those brochures? No.
I don't know. I guess my question is, are there a lot of Northern Highland games?
There are loads of Northern Highland games. They're just very different from Southern ones. So you go to Northern, I've been to the ones in Loon Mountain in New Hampshire, and there were 3 clan tents the year I went. At Grandfather Mountain, you might have 160. There aren't even that many clans. But a lot of the tents are heritage societies that put up displays and things, too. And that really is the focus. In the Northern games, people did this bizarre thing. They sat and watched the competitions all day. Yeah, they watched bagpipers play and watched Highland dancers dance. I mean, it was amazing. But yeah, there's a very different focus on that. There's not this emphasis on we're all kin, we're all cousins of some sort.
Yeah.
Well, I wouldn't go along with authors like Cunningham, The Apples and the Flood, and all that. I mean, I don't think any of this is a genetic memory. Culture is totally something you learn. So I would say the hyper-masculinity, the militarism, is in part due to a defeatist mentality. I mean, Scotland still has a huge crisis of conscience. And even though confidence, not... They may have a crisis of conscience, too. But they have a crisis of confidence. And... You know, what did they have to do after the defeat in Culloden? The Highlands were decimated. Culloden was this battle I mentioned that happened in 1746. And even though it was just the Highlanders that supported the restoration of Stuarts to the throne, the whole of Scotland was punished and became just North Britain because of it. So Scots had not a lot going for them. And a lot of people's choice was to take the king's shilling, you know, to join the army. So Scotland disproportionately contributed men to the military per capita. It was very disproportionate, just like the South. Yeah, I wouldn't get into the whole genetic memory suction thing. I'm really into enculturation, you know, what the context in which you're brought up. Sorry if that disappoints. Where do the Huguenots fit in? Well, they just are fantastic. And, you know, some of them come to the games in Charleston, being close by. I don't know how much interaction they had with Presbyterians because They settled in places that Presbyterians didn't so much go to. There's a lovely Presbyterian church in Charleston, but Huguenots very much don't go there. So I wouldn't connect the two, but there is an entry in the volume, and it's right out on a table. So you can have a look at the Huguenot entry. Yeah, Jim?
Could you comment briefly on this gentleman?
Okay, so General Kirby Smith. I teach at Suwanee. Jim's an alum of Suwanee, and General Kirby Smith was the one general who refused to ever concede that the war was over. And he went skipping down through Mexico and Cuba and eventually was given some sort of pardon, though I don't think he even officially accepted that. He came to Suwanee and taught math. And this was his battle flag, which is the flag of Scotland. So a lot of times at Scottish games, you will see people wearing Scottish flags. It'll be a Scottish flag on one side, the St. Andrew's cross, and then what Southerners did with that in the Confederate battle flag on the other side, because it was a direct borrowing of the saltire, the Scottish flag. Yeah.
This is sort of a serious question. I'm curious
about... A serious question.
Well, sort of. It's a ridiculous question, but can you imagine if we started having Anglo-Saxon festivals and raised the banner of...
England's St. doing George it. And England's doing it. Have you not seen the St. George flags?
Can you imagine? Although, as I was sitting here, I was sort of thinking about things like the Sons of Colonial Wars and outfits like that. I said, well, I didn't want to hang out with you when I was in college, but I might want to start now. But, I mean, that would be sort of a curiosity to have an Anglo-Saxon group.
There are an awful lot of Anglo-Saxons who do this. They're from the lowlands. They're from the lowlands of Scotland, which wouldn't have had a clan society, but they opt for it because it's a Celtic revision. They're no longer WASP. They're not WASP. They are Celtic, and that's much more interesting to them.
What do you think about an Albion Sea?
Oh, what's
this? I think that took a lot of research to write that book. That's all I'm going to say about that. It's a book by David Hackett Fisher, Albion Seed, which is a fascinating read. And a lot of it is flights of I won't say fantasy, but there's he's looking at one topic narrowly and making what he can of it. But it's immigration of people from Britain and how they shaped mostly Appalachia, but also Lowcountry South.
Have you in your research found any sympathy with the people who go to these Highland games with the political efforts in Scotland for independence from the UK?
Well, they love the Queen. And the Queen will stay no matter what happens, but there's interest. One year, the SNP came, that's the Scottish Nationalist Party, for those of you who don't know, came to the Grandfather Mountain Highland Games, but they didn't have enough people stopping by the tent, so they decided it was too expensive to do that. And really, a lot of Scots, the chattering classes, don't think it would be advantageous for Scotland to be totally devolved. I mean, then they'd just be answerable to the EU in the same way they're answerable to Whitehall. But.
And secondly, in your research, have you studied differences in Presbyterian churches in the South that have a distinct Scots emphasis with other Presbyterian churches in the South?
I haven't looked at the ones that don't. I tend to go to the ones that have kirking of the tartans, you know, which is this tradition where you would have tartan banners blessed. And we know this happened in World War II because a Senate chaplain, Peter Marshall, decided it would be a nice service to happen. And so he introduced this as a way of praying for Britons during the war. But by now, people have come up with stories about it, that it's this ancient tradition. And before the Battle of Culloden, everyone took their, you know, little swatches of tartan or their kilts to be blessed by their minister. Well, there are very few areas of the Highlands at that point that were still Catholic, and Presbyterians aren't into icons. So, but I tend to look at the ones that are actively commemorating their Scottish origins. Yes, please.
One thing I've noticed that's kind of popular at Highland Games here is that they do a lot of dogs because of the
border collies. No, but they're used there.
Okay.
They were bred in the borders, but they're wonderful sheepdogs, so they're used all over. Yeah, that they're interested in the animals. Yeah, I should have had a picture.
I have a final question.
Yes, please.
Have you been to the Highland Games in Glasgow, Kentucky?
I have.
They're
up there with Stone Mountain. So if Grandfather Mountain's at the top, that's where most clan societies have their AGM meetings every year. The next places people want to go in the south is Stone Mountain and Glasgow. Glasgow, pretty nice games. Pretty nice games. Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.